In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
You walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. The UFO crash in Aztec, New Mexico is often eclipsed by the extensive reporting and lore of the Roswell, New Mexico UFO crash event. However, in the context of recent congressional subcommittee testimony confirming recovered crash, non-human piloted aerial vehicles, and related biologics, the Aztec incident might be considered another very prominent UFO crash retrieval. While the UFO crash in Roswell, New Mexico has been the focus within the public memory and entertainment, it turns out up to 9 UFO craft seem to lose control and crash in the southwestern U.S. in the late 1940s. The locations include Roswell, New Mexico, Aztec, New Mexico, Laredo, Texas, and Paradise Valley, Arizona. We take a look at some details of this extraordinary case in Aztec, New Mexico, where on March 25, 1948, an unidentified disc-shaped vehicle, quote, gently pancaked to earth, landing 12 miles outside of the small town on a mesa in Hart Canyon. Government and military personnel, scientists and intelligence agents converged into the area and, as reported, made a full recovery of the flying craft, along with up to 16 occupants. During this operation, it was noted that one of the smallest occupants measured 23 inches in height. Meanwhile, the town of Aztec was under strict surveillance lockdown as the 200-person operation recovered and sanitized the area. Those who witnessed the incident were told it was their patriotic duty to keep quiet. However, this containment led to lifetime surveillance for some. From this point on, as many ufologists are aware, the stories told of what happened on that brisk March day in 1948 were conflicted. For decades, media echoed attempts to deride the event as a hoax. Yet, diligent researchers such as Scott and Suzanne Ramsey pushed forward through the mirage. Another determined researcher is our guest, Rick Keefe. Rick is a longtime UFO researcher, a journalist, documentary filmmaker, and blog author. He lives in Arizona with his wife. Rick has amassed some of the most in-depth and intriguing interviews of alien contactees, abductees, UFO eyewitnesses, and military insiders. His high-quality documentary film work, articles, and blog can be found at ufohypotheses.com. Rick, welcome to Another News.
Well, thanks, Jeff, for having me. I appreciate being invited.
Rick, you've been immersed in the Aztec UFO crash from 2004 to 2010. You've also chronicled the obscure military history surrounding the event in your documentary work. Please give listeners some of your background as a journalist and researcher, and when did you find out about the Aztec UFO incident?
Okay, so all three of those are kind of larger questions in a way, so I'll go ahead and start here, Jeff. The documentary work that you're referring to are films that I made and released free to YouTube back in about 2007, 2008. The two I have released so far are about the Aztec crash. First one's titled Aztec Chapter 1. Second one's Aztec Chapter 2 featuring Wendell Stevens, which won the People's Choice Award at the International UFO Congress in 2008. So search out UFOHYPOTHESES on YouTube. That's hypotheses, the plural of hypothesis. At some point over the next several years, I will release 15 more volumes in the series. So back at that time, most UFO researchers who made films would release and sell them on DVD and VHS. My wife and I gave out the DVDs for free. I felt that the information that I compiled needed to get to a wider audience because of its what I felt was profound social and economic significance. After a fellow UFO Congress attendee named Jim Aho informed me about YouTube, I chose to make them free on YouTube, and this was when YouTube was just beginning. I also sent free DVD copies all over the world to help spread the information and to make sure that it would not be covered up. So that was a real concern for me after having seen how so many UFO researchers had been attacked over the decades. Those researchers include Bill Cooper, Paul Benowitz, Philip Corso, Dr. James McDonald, Morris K. Jessup, Jim Lorenzen, Phil Schneider, Dr. Carla Turner, and Elaine Douglas, who all met untimely and suspicious deaths, among other UFO researchers who faced character assassinations. So I felt the best way to get this information out to the public was by making it free. And I do feel the public has become much more informed on these topics in the last several decades due to other persistent UFO researchers, which is encouraging. Plus, the much advanced internet speeds help too. So you said, please give listeners some of your background as a journalist and researcher. As far as my background as a journalist and researcher goes, I'm just a regular dude at heart. I studied writing, television, and film at the University of Arizona for 6 years in the 1980s, and I had several strange incidents happening in my life then. When I shared one event with a coworker named Chris at a video store where we worked in the 1980s, he told me about an author named Strieber, who had just appeared on The Tonight Show talking about his real-life encounter with extraterrestrials. Chris shared Whitley Strieber's book called Communion with me. Early on in the book, it recounted a type of event that had also happened to me involving an oversized 4-foot white owl, and that led me on a decades-long quest to discover what was at the root of that incident in my life. So I began voraciously reading about the UFO topic and all its related areas, co-hosted a couple public access television shows on those topics over several years, met numerous well-informed, experienced people in this field of research, and spent many decades engaged in serious study. All this was just for personal edification and reconciling the strange events that had happened to me and kept happening to me. I had no financial motive. So Jeff, you know, I felt that I needed to learn what the philosophies and agendas of the various ET civilizations were. I started out reading about the Pleiadians, and then, you know, as I kept going, I learned about other different civilizations, and I wanted to try to piece together the structure of what was happening to me and what was happening on Earth, and learn why our social systems operated the way they did, and whether or not that included interference from extraterrestrials, both malevolent and benevolent. And then you asked, when did you find out about the Aztec UFO crash recovery and cover-up? So one of the cameramen from some of the public access shows that I was involved with came into our pop culture store, Our Galaxy, after the turn of the millennium and updated me about some of the goings-on regarding several of my co-hosts on Ted Lohman's public access show, UFOAZ. I learned that the co-host that had replaced me on the show when I left, and her name is Peggy Kane, she was now deeply involved in research regarding extraterrestrial reptilian beings, or reptoids as some call them. And the cameraman thought I should speak with another co-host about all that, Jim Nichols. So with Jim Nichols, he suggested that I interview Peggy. And so I dug deep into research about reptilians so that I could do a well-informed documentary about Peggy and her reverse speech research. So I searched for some missing Alex Collier videos that I had made back in 1994-95, which I had lost track of in the plethora of books and videos that I had collected. And no matter how hard I looked, I just could not turn those Collier videos up. But I gathered whatever I could find on reptilian ETs, read David Icke's material, and prepared to interview Peggy. Around the same time, I decided to contact Lieutenant Colonel Wendell C. Stevens again, who I had interviewed on video in his backyard in 1993 about the Pleiadians and the Billy Meyer contact case. And so I asked Wendell Stevens if I could interview him again about various ET species. Wendell agreed to come over to my home and sit down for an interview and claimed he really didn't know too much about reptilians, and that when he did have leads about ET contact cases involving reptilians, he almost always passed those cases on to other researchers and told me about researcher John Rhodes. But during this first 2004 interview with Wendell, I kept pursuing the matter, rephrasing the questions, and I got Wendell to begin to share some of what he knew about reptilians. I asked for another interview session, and he agreed. Then, because I was pretty well prepared with my questions, and because my interview style and knowledge was decent, Wendell just started pouring out information of all kinds to me, and I just went with the flow of the conversations and then guided him back to my follow-up questions. I also would buy some of Wendell's books each time he visited me in our dining area at my home where we set up for those interviews, and then I would read more. So after several days of interviews over the course of several months, I asked Wendell why he had not written about his amazing life as an Air Force pilot, also a gold-seeking adventurer, and a world-famous UFO investigator. He explained that he had many ongoing UFO investigations that kept him too busy from doing that. He also told me that he had turned down several people who wanted to do his biography. But after many months of doing interviews with Wendell, he agreed to let me write his biography, and we ended up doing interviews about all 60 years of cases during 2004 to 2010, close to 100 hours of interviews. This period is when I learned about the Aztec crash case and questioned him a great deal about the Aztec evidence and evidence that connects this case with so many other areas in UFO research. So the Aztec case connects to several of the crash retrieval cases that you were to mention in your introduction, to Los Alamos and the 1940s radar station in New Mexico, to Roswell, to Socorro, to William Cooper's information, to Lieutenant Colonel Philip Corso's book, The Day After Roswell, to the Farmington flyover case involving daytime sightings over several days of scores of, well, actually hundreds of flying saucers in March 1950, to underground ETs in Dulce, New Mexico, to the fast development of certain technology and weapons, to aviation corporations, and to the creation of the CIA and the NSA for counterintelligence control of all of this information. And because this flying saucer landed virtually intact, the Aztec case may relate directly to the advancement of semiconductors and more powerful computers, fiber optics, night vision, advanced propulsion and energy systems, military science advances of all kinds, and the rise of artificial intelligence and the military's understanding of various exobiological organisms. So yeah, I felt that it was important for me to learn about that back then, and I believe for society to know about now.
Rick, thank you for going into depth there. I really appreciate that. And focusing in on the Aztec UFO incident, would you please summarize the events on that day, March 25th, 1948, near Aztec, New Mexico?
Okay, sure, Jeff. But this may take several minutes to explain, so listeners, please be patient. The two documentaries that I've released so far look to explain who and what were in control of the U.S. government prior to the Aztec crash. When I was going over the history of the spacecraft's removal from Hart Canyon and conveyance to Los Alamos, there were indications that equipment hauling trucks were camouflaged to look like oil drilling rigs during the relocating process to Los Alamos. This seemed like it would take a lot of quick coordination with the oil industry in the area, and I thought that was really interesting. So I began to explore U.S. history backwards from the date of the Aztec crash and discovered a lot about the structures of financial power within U.S. history going back a century before the crash. That research began to explain so much about who, how, and why the crashes were being covered up and how everything could be contained and compartmentalized. So those two documentaries I made have enormously important facts to apprehend in understanding who the power of the U.S. rested with, and how they were able to control the military for their personal benefits. I think it's vital to know who benefited and financially retained control of the United States in order to place all this flying saucer history into a truthful, modern context. So as far as March 25th, 1948 goes, in the Four Corners area of New Mexico, where Aztec is situated, there was one of three strategic radar sites, and this particular station had very high-powered experimental radar, and it has been surmised by some researchers as having an effect on an unidentified flying object that Air Defense Control had encountered, somehow disrupting the craft's control mechanism. This may or may not be true. Now, in your introduction today, you mentioned that this 100-foot diameter flying disc soft landed on a mesa in Hart Canyon intact with only the most minimal damage. This soft landing, no damage crash results for an out-of-control craft would have been nearly impossible given the dangerous cliffs and terrain in the area of Hart Canyon and the speed such a craft would likely descend at. The odds for no damage might be astronomical, no pun intended, but kind of, yes. So what I suspect happened, though, was that the craft was placed there on purpose, flown with remote control by an extraterrestrial group that had an understanding of the hidden internal structure of the U.S. government at that time. I feel that ET group knew how the U.S. government was likely to respond with a gifted, intact flying disc and that super advanced technology that it contained. These ETs would have known that humans were likely to try to pull the craft apart and try to understand how it worked, and then attempt to copy it and to back engineer the craft's functions and systems. If this were the case, that the completely intact UFO was gifted to the government by an extraterrestrial species, what are the implications of that event on the next several generations of humanity? Because consider this, that extraterrestrial race already had technology equal or likely much better than what they were gifted to the technology inferior Earth humans. So did the U.S. government fall for a Trojan horse type event and become entrained by an ET race because of their greed to have exclusive control of this technology, which would be vastly superior to other nations' technologies? That's an interesting question. Would this extraterrestrial race perhaps be guiding Earth towards an outcome that would somehow benefit itself more than Earth humanity by setting up advanced electronic technologies that they could ultimately control with their superior technologies? I don't know. What do you think about that, Jeff? Would the Earth humans with this new technology that they back-engineered alter their natural course of development and become too advanced too quickly without the necessary wisdom or compassion about what may result? Like possibly creating a huge dependence on these electronic systems that maybe scientifically lead to artificial intelligence systems that could be easily controlled by this extraterrestrial race. So I want to share news from this week of mid-February 2025, and this is from space.com. You can go there and read this article for yourself. Scientists say artificial intelligence has crossed a critical red line and has replicated itself. In a new study, researchers from China showed that two popular large language models could clone themselves. Quote, successful self-replication under no human assistance is the essential step for AI to outsmart humans and is an early signal for rogue AIs, the researchers wrote in the study published December 9th, 2024. So as we have our discussion today, I think these are important concepts for the listeners to consider and contemplate. One last point to contemplate. The events of March 15th to 18th, 1950, in a neighboring city to Aztec called Farmington. Here is a headline from the Farmington Daily Times from that week, and I quote, "Huge saucer armada jolts Farmington." I feel certain that the Aztec crash and the Farmington UFO armada are connected. So back to the basics of the Aztec crash itself. As a consequence of a possible lightning strike, a brush fire had sprung up in Hart Canyon, roughly 12 miles northeast of Aztec. This fire immediately attracted several concerned oil workers who first discovered the crash while trying to check on the fire and the status of a company oil field drip tank. Among the other early witnesses to the crash turned up by the Ramseys include two El Paso oil employees, 19-year-old Doug Nolan and his older boss, Bill Ferguson, and Ken Farley, not from this area, and his friend from nearby Cedar Hill, whom he was visiting. These witnesses observed the disc craft itself, along with a husband and wife ranching couple who arrived, and two police officers who all had arrived in several vehicles that had rushed down the dirt road into Hart Canyon. As stated earlier, there was no noticeable damage to the molded, seamless, dull gray spacecraft that they could find initially. Several people started climbing onto the craft. It had a bubble configuration in its center, about 18 feet in diameter. One of the police officers, Manuel Sandoval, told Nolan, the 19-year-old oil worker, that he had seen the flying disc in the sky and followed from nearby Cuba, New Mexico. The second police officer was known by several of the other local witnesses there at the scene. When Nolan was climbing on the craft, he claimed to see two humanoid beings through a window in the bubbled center of the ship and that they did not appear to be conscious. Then a helicopter began circling the area. And shortly after that, the military arrived in great number and harshly threatened the witnesses' lives and swore everyone to secrecy, insisting it was their patriotic duty. The original witnesses were sent away from the crash site under threat. In late 1987, researcher Leonard Stringfield contacted law enforcement officer Gabe Valdez of Dulce, New Mexico, who had a reliable elderly witness who recalled seeing the craft hauled away on a giant flatbed truck. The witness also said that a military officer told him the saucer was only an airplane, but had threatened him to keep quiet. From this point forward, in late March 1948, the military were in control of the spacecraft. According to authors and researchers Bill Steinman and Lieutenant Colonel Wendell Stevens, General George C. Marshall, currently also Secretary of State, took command of the operation and contacted the MJ-12 group of very high-ranking military leaders, intelligence officers, and military scientists, closely associated also with very, very wealthy family oligarchs. I should note here that the CIA was created just prior to the crash on September 18, 1947, and Naval Intelligence's Operational Intelligence Section was created a year earlier in 1946. What isn't discussed much is the Army Counterintelligence Special Unit created after the Roswell and Magdalena crashes, called the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit. Now, I know the Ramseys have done some work about this too. So after General Marshall's call, then MJ-12 contacted the IPU, which was operating out of Camp Hale, Colorado. And this is from where the helicopter that was responding to the crash scene originated. At this point, all need-to-know communications was only allowed between General Marshall and the 1st IPU. The Air Defense Command was taken off alert, local military went back to normal daily routines, and the radar stations were told that the signals were a false alarm. The situation was now in full counterintelligence mode, lying and falsifying to all subordinate branches of the military and government. Linda Moulton's Howe research in 1999 turned up an intelligence officer who confessed to her that he had doctored and placed disinformation in over 200 personnel files of military personnel who had any connection with the Aztec crash recovery operation. His job as a falsifier was so that if years later any of them confessed to being part of the operation, that the military records would show them being located at different faraway bases of operation during the crash and recovery period. He admitted to Howe about spicing up the files with various and sundry completely false notations, such as, quote, "He sprained his ankle playing volleyball and was in the infirmary for 2 days." So the available literature mentions up to 16 occupants, and I'll let you have a breath here, Jeff, and I'll take a breath too.
Rick, thank you for another in-depth answer here, and guess listeners are getting the picture that Rick has prepared immensely for this interview, because you know, we're talking about tracing back where some of the AI could have come from, where a lot of the technology that we have in our lives right now, where did it suddenly come from? Humans could have certainly gone through a technological evolution very quickly, but a lot of people suspect there's something else going on as well. And now that we have this area really opening up that was once very, very secretive for many decades, it's time that more people understand, you know, the bigger picture here. So I appreciate you doing all this work to prepare for this interview, because you have a major body of work that you've brought forward for people to absorb and consume here, and it's very important as well.
Well, thanks for saying so, Jeff. I appreciate that, and I agree. I think it's really important. I tried to share a lot. There were reasons why I kind of backed away, which I'll explain later. But it's important, and I feel, you know, I've been away from the field of ufology for about 14 years. I've still been studying it, but I have not been really putting out information, although I've been gathering it and analyzing it and speaking with other people in the field, but not really being public about it. But I do appreciate your invitation today. Thank you.
Oh, that's interesting to know, Rick. I didn't know that. Okay, so the available literature mentions there were allegedly up to 16 occupants. They were non-human and apparently all deceased. Their heights ranged from 4'9" to 23". It was reported they all wore uniforms. Please tell listeners what you've learned about the occupants.
So first, a little about the team of scientists that MJ-12 and the First Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit, which I will refer to as the IPU from here on, assembled to investigate this crash, having anticipated such an event ever since Roswell 9 months earlier. So the World War II wartime agency called the Office of Scientific Research and Development was changed in peacetime to the Research and Development Board. Dr. Vannevar Bush was its director, and he would lead the IPU's team of scientists for the Aztec crash. Following are among the scientists invited onto the team by Bush. This list of scientists is from Steinman and Stevens' book, UFO Crash at Aztec. First, somebody everybody is probably now familiar with after the movie last year, Dr. J. Robert Oppenheimer, the physicist based in Los Alamos who led the atomic bomb development. He was a key player in this Aztec crash recovery and then analysis afterward of the ship and the mechanics involved in the ship. Princeton mathematician Dr. John Van Neumann, who had replaced Nikola Tesla on the Navy's Philadelphia experiment 5 years earlier in 1943. It was von Neumann who had increased the power output on that naval experiment, contrary to Tesla's design, which caused that space-time rip disaster. Dr. Detlev Bronk, a renowned physiologist and biophysicist associated with the Atomic Energy Commission, and also with Brookhaven National Laboratory and the Army Air Force's Air Surgeon Office. Geophysicist and electrical engineer Dr. Lloyd V. Berkner, Executive Secretary of the Research and Development Board under Bush's direction. Dr. Carl A. Hyland, geophysicist and magnetic engineer, head of geophysics at the Colorado School of Mines, Colorado being the state Camp Hale was located from which the helicopter that arrived at the scene originated. He was also part of the original MJ-12 panel set up in 1947. It was Hyland who unknowingly would leak sensitive information regarding the Aztec crash in his office to a workplace associate named Leo Gebauer, or Gebauer. I'm not sure how that's pronounced. Dr. Horace B. Vandenberg, an inorganic chemistry expert from the University of Colorado. He was also a member of the original MJ-12 panel. Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Dr. Jerome C. Hunsaker, head of MIT's Department of Aeronautical Engineering. And there were several other specialists, including Dr. Merle A. Tuvey, who also worked for research and development during and after World War II, and was also a member of the original MJ-12 panel. So this was Dr. Vannevar Bush's team that flew to the crash site from Durango Airfield on a top-secret mission to Hart Canyon near Aztec. Bush was in complete charge of the scientific aspects of this operation, and Bush reported to General Marshall. It's important to know how the secrecy was broken later on. Leo Gay Bauer was one of the many associates of Dr. Carl A. Hyland in magnetics research, according to William Steinman, and it was Gay Bauer who picked up various bits of information over time from Hyland. After many months of gathering information, Gay Bauer leaked the top secret Aztec crash details he had learned about to his friend and associate Silas Newton, while they were both working together on sophisticated oil detection technologies. Together, they leaked it to journalist Frank Scully, and Silas Newton publicly disclosed the Aztec crash at the University of Denver in a surprise lecture during lunch hour on March 15, 1950. To be clear, Dr. Hyland never knowingly broke any of his security oaths. Gay Bauer just snooped well and gathered what data he could over a long period of time. Now, as far as answering your question on the extraterrestrial biologic entities, I will skip past the military lockdown and land grab phase, the initial exterior inspection phase, how the scientists were able to enter the craft, and go directly to the IPU's initial discovery of the alien bodies. So when he was crawling upon the 100-foot diameter disc craft, the 19-year-old oil worker had seen two bodies slumped over a very sophisticated instrument panel with hieroglyphics, it turns out, that when Oppenheimer saw the panel, he remarked that the glyphs appeared to have appearance very similar to Sanskrit. And as a side note, I think that might be a clue to what the Mahabharata may be referencing in its Indian mythologies involving sky vehicles. Once the IPO team had found a way to enter the craft, those were the first two bodies they found. Upon further examination of the craft, a chamber was discovered where they found an additional 12 bodies, all burnt and charred upon the floor. All these bodies were taken outside the craft, laid upon the ground, and Dr. Bronk immediately began his careful first examination of the bodies. Bronk and Bush decided they should rush to preserve the bodies. Bush quickly contacted a specialist in cryogenics, Dr. Paul A. Scherer, who advised using dry ice, and then Scherer began making contact with cryogenic specialists as close to Los Alamos as possible. Here I'm going to jump ahead in the chronology events to when the craft and bodies had already been successfully transported in secrecy to Los Alamos. Dr. Detlev Bronk began fully examining several of the extraterrestrial bodies, their anatomical, biophysical, and physiological composition, and part of his report was included in Project Sign Report 13. Bronk, and that is different than Project Grudge Report 13, so that's Project Sign Report 13. Bronk found their appearance to have somewhat oriental features, but with thin, small necks, torsos, and long, slender arms that reached to their knees, and their fingers had webbing between them. There was no digestive tract, no intestines, no rectal point, no reproductive organs, and no red blood cells. Instead of blood, they had colorless liquid that smelled like ozone. Bronk considered the possibility that some of these beings may have been manufactured life forms. Here are some other interesting details that Frank Scully reported in his book, Behind the Flying Saucers. Scully reported that the crew did not carry any weapons of any kind. A thread from their clothing took 450 pounds of weight to break it. The water on board was twice as heavy as our drinking water. Their food supply appeared to be little wafers that swelled up when water was added. Scully reported that all the beings had perfect teeth. that they all wore dark blue uniforms, appeared to be, by our age standards, between 35 to 40 years of age. Each member of the crew had a timepiece that was set to run on a scheme of 23 hours and 58 minutes, which is equivalent to one magnetic day. Steinman and, now I'm going to digress a little bit here. Steinman and Stevens' book details numerous reports of alien bodies and goes into specific detail about four general group types that contactees, abductees, and other witnesses had described up to the point of publication of the book in the mid-1980s. Interestingly, Steinman details a lengthy investigation he pursued on pages 276 to 279 of UFO Crash at Aztec called Dr. Steen and the Live Alien. After following several leads, Steinman's investigation and conversation with a Dr. J led to his testimony that a nurse of a Dr. Claude E. Steen had confided that Steen had performed a physical examination of a living humanoid who was taken from, and I quote here, was taken from the disabled flying saucer that was recovered by U.S. military in northwestern New Mexico in 1948. The non-identified nurse accompanied Dr. Steen on this examination. The nurse, whose identity and anonymity was very protected by the doctor, who acknowledged Dr. Steen, so this is that Dr. J, who was already deceased by the time of Steinman's interview, was very frightened by the living extraterrestrial. This was the nurse, which the nurse described as, quote, very human but very reptilian at the same time, and that it, quote, must have originated from the pits of hell, close quote. Steinman then reports from pages 293 to 300 and 380 to 381 additional supporting information about possible reptilian extraterrestrial species. Steinman does report his account of a photographer named Von Papen who had more details on the bodies. Dr. Busch did task Dr. Scherer to cryogenically preserve the bodies for future research. Air Research Corporation, which Scherer had been director of from 1940 to 1944, supplied liquid nitrogen pumps, air circulation systems, and refrigeration units to the military, which Dr. Scherer employed for the project. The units Scherer fashioned utilized liquid nitrogen to essentially deep freeze at sub-zero temperatures the alien bodies, which were wrapped and then stored in cylinders for future study and ease of transport. And so here at this point, Jeff, I have a few observations that I would like to add. These are personal observations, and they are not necessarily indicated in any of the, by any of the researchers that I've quoted so far.
Okay.
Okay, cool. So I feel that it's possible that the occupant alien bodies discovered were not the ones who piloted the craft into Hart Canyon, but were left in the ship by another group of extraterrestrials with the intact ship, all to be discovered by the U.S. government. The U.S. was arguably the world's most powerful nation just after World War II. My theory is that the bodies were necessary to prove that this craft was extraterrestrial, even possibly extra-dimensional, and not created by a foreign nation on Earth. The alien bodies would make the proof undeniable to whomever discovered the spacecraft, which would be the U.S. military leadership. Several people within the U.S. government, highly placed by the controlling financial families, would also have been briefed in a compartmentalized way and given instructions on how to respond to any leaks into the civilian sector. Thus, when Scully came out with his book, they were fully prepared with their media powers and their justice system to discredit his work and to destroy his reputation and those of his sources, Silas Newton and Leo Gebauer. This would, in effect, shield those ETs that may have remotely landed the craft in Hart Canyon, because no one in the press would be trying to figure out how a flying disc crashed undamaged if it was concluded by the courts and mass media that the event never occurred in the first place. Secondly, The various dead occupants were likely considered by the species that placed them and the spacecraft near Aztec to be an inferior or opposing species by the beings that were in remote control of the ship. And as some evidence suggests, like the perfect teeth, some of these bodies may have been manufactured clones, and none of them were privy to weapons for self-defense.
If these occupants did not have a digestive tract, why did they have teeth, I wonder?
That's a good point. I was wondering the same thing, but that's what was reported. They all had perfect teeth. So maybe that was a kind of self-defense mechanism. Who knows? But I've heard the theory that some of their alimentation was brought in through liquids and some of it was absorbed directly through their skin. So those are potentialities, but yeah, very good observation.
And if they are genetically made, it could be some kind of vestigial, you know, anomaly in the DNA possibly. I don't know, like a vestigial tail in humans, that kind of thing.
Or maybe if they were meant to communicate, it was functional in their communication of words and phrases.
I agree. I was thinking that as well. There are a lot of secondary uses for teeth, you know, aside from breaking down food. Okay, please talk about the craft. I read in William Steinman's and Wendell Stevens' book titled UFO Crash at Aztec, A Well-Kept Secret, how a recovery worker found a way to unlatch the craft in sections. This is after failed attempts at using diamond-tipped drills and diamond-tipped saws. Please talk more about that, and where do you suspect the sections were taken?
All right, Jeff. So once the scientific team had arrived at the crash site, the ranchers that owned that land, they were held in incommunicado. They were threatened, and they were moved away from the scene. The ranchers, it was a husband and wife, as I understand it. The ranchers' livestock was quarantined for health and safety concerns as well, and the other civilians and local police were also escorted away, threatened to secrecy, and sent on their way, and probably surveilled for many months after or longer. According to Steinman, there was a short period of awe and amazement as the scientists stood outside the craft, some taking in the whole scene and others already examining the seamless contoured disc craft. The only damage they could find at all was a minute hole with the width of about 1/8 of an inch in one of the portholes up on the bubble section of the craft. Now this hole it wasn't glass material, but it was a porthole. This could have caused the death of the beings on board due to inrushing gases. That's a potential. Reporter Frank Scully said that the crash retrieval unit studied the ship for over one day from the outside, utilizing Geiger counters and dispersing cosmic rays throughout the craft to kill anything remaining alive inside, and studying all the ambient radiation levels before even trying to enter it. So, you know, I'm thinking if those were live beings, or some of them had survived, if that's what happened or what they were using the cosmic rays for, and maybe they killed off some that were still alive in the craft. All of them were burnt and charred, so maybe the cosmic rays contributed to that. I don't know. The manner of entry into the craft took some time to discover. Eventually, looking in through one of the bubble dome's portholes, a protruding knob-type button was seen along a cabin wall. They smashed a hole through the damaged porthole, procured a pole, and pressed this button, which to their amazement did in fact open a door downward that gave access to the ship's interior. After one of the military workers noticed a series of interlocking key devices, they did find a way to open up seams in the ship from top to bottom, allowing the personnel to disassemble the 33-yard ship into smaller sections for transport. Scully wrote that the ship had no weapons at all. Scully also reported that the scientists decided against pressing any of the instrument panel's buttons for fear the ship could start up and they wouldn't know how to turn it off. The saucer itself was light. Three large men could somewhat lift up one side of the ship. However, the thin metal could withstand 10,000 degrees of heat and the diamond drills you mentioned. So Bush and von Neumann were fascinated by what they presumed to be a wireless navigation and interior settings control panel. Hyland's description of this panel that was overheard by Leo Gebauer revealed that the panel had no microcircuitry, much like today's modern semiconductor-driven integrated computer devices. Bush and von Neumann were amazed at how compact the device was, just like today's technology 77 years later. To me, when you consider Philip Corso's book, The Day After Roswell, these items strongly indicate to me that this alien technology was integrated into certain corporate technology companies chosen by powerful oligarchs and powerful military leaders, and then back-engineered and released to appear as inventions by corporate scientists when in fact it was gifted alien technology. As well, this suggests to me a conflict of interest against the benefits to all the citizens of the United States, and instead the top secrecy favors and aids only the already entrenched uber-wealthy oligarchs, top intelligence leaders, and insider military high command, some of which were Nazis brought here through Project Paperclip. These people could invest in the proper companies because they had insider information about which corporations would appear to make huge technological breakthroughs. Then, like a Wall Street shell game, assets would be merged, exchanged, companies sold off or renamed to keep hiding the money trails over the next many decades. Okay, so back to the crash site. From the crash site, it was determined by Marshall and Bush that the craft would be taken to Los Alamos because time was of the essence to maintain as much secrecy as possible regarding the craft. There are strong indications that a concrete slab was poured at the crash site to assist in the use of a crane that lifted the sections of the saucer and placed them onto several trucks. After 3 days of work by the first Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit, its scientists and military crew, Dr. Bush and General Marshall were ready to convey the disk spacecraft and all it contained to Los Alamos and chose to start heading out through Hart Canyon's east end. With roadblocks in place, these hauling trucks and oil drilling rigs carried sections of the craft and were covered with canvas tarps using oil prospecting as a cover story. The trucks were labeled as carrying explosives. They traveled only by night over the least populated roads and at some points simply crossed over the land as needed. The trail made by hauling the craft overland was scrubbed and sanitized of any evidence they could find, and they did a very, very thorough job. However, some clues remained. Some of the materials of the recovered craft were discovered in later years. The concrete slab remained. Some of the treetops had been cut and broken off. Some rocks were charred. And, importantly, a telex came across the desk of an Army G2 counterintelligence officer stationed at Fort Bragg in North Carolina, a Captain Virgil A. Postlethwaite. Postlethwaite testified to UFO crash retrieval expert Leonard Stringfield that this highly classified telex read as follows. So this is Stringfield's report from Postlethwaite. And he had memorized this message because it was that sensational and made such an impression on Postlethwaite. Quote, flying object, this is the telex, quote, flying object of unknown origin recovered near Aztec, New Mexico. Craft approximately 100 feet diameter, 30 feet high, one window port blown. Bodies on board, all occupants dead, 4 feet high, oversized heads. Craft has metallic skin, thin as newspaper, but too tough to penetrate by conventional tools. Private property was purchased from locals in order to facilitate transporting the craft to base. Close quote. So Postlethwaite said that he did handle this telex and that he memorized its entire message.
Scott Ramsey, in his book, mentions some of that material was brought to the craft, was brought to Los Alamos. But I'm still reading that book. And as a side note, I was stationed at Fort Bragg in the late 80s. And
interesting.
Oh, yeah. And every month there was a circulation of guard duty. And when your time came up, you were out doing guard duty at night. And I was pulling a guard duty. It was 3 a.m. And sure enough, that was my first UFO that I saw right near Pope Air Force Base.
They have an extremely high interest in what goes on at Air Force bases. Anywhere that there might be advanced technology, and also anywhere that there might be nuclear weapons.
It makes sense to me. Rick, you mentioned Frank Scully. He's an author, journalist, and humorist, and he was a prominent regular columnist for the film industry trade magazine Variety. He was one of the first to bring this story to the public in his book, as you mentioned, Behind the Flying Saucers. He described the craft as, quote, pancaking to Earth. Please talk about some of the ways researchers suspect this disc lost control and descended onto a mesa in Hart Canyon.
Okay, Jeff. I could report on other researchers' assessments, but as I shared before my speculation, I'm going to continue with that line because I'm really suspicious that a vehicle could make such a clean landing. When you hear about all the other crash retrievals, they are not clean. So here's my own speculation about what happened. And for some of your well-informed listeners who already know about Dulce, New Mexico, and the underground battle that Phil Schneider reported before his untimely and suspicious death, and your listeners who already know about the Farmington flyover of hundreds of spaceships witnessed by hundreds of New Mexico residents, what I'm going to suggest may make more sense than to others who may be listening to this interview who are not yet familiar with those two particular pieces of information. So, the conclusion that I've held for nearly 20 years is that the spacecraft was landed there by remote control and made to look like a crash, but gently enough landed not to cause any major damage because it was meant to be found intact by our society, by those who left it. And its technology was meant to be integrated into the fabric of our global societies. The simplest analogy might be like secretly leaving within a kindergarten class a kite made of wooden dowels, pre-cut sheets of plastic, and string all ready to fly, except for the attaching of the string. However, this would be done knowing that one or two of the children would be bright enough to attach the string. Imagine running with it and eventually discover how to use it with the wind and finally successfully fly the kite. Then, soon enough, all the kids would be making and flying kites. And soon, maybe these strategizing extraterrestrials will have most of us using and relying on artificial intelligence instead of ourselves, making us very vulnerable to external control and loss of freedoms. Or perhaps allow rogue AI to create a global catastrophe like the many scenarios that science fiction writers have cautioned us about for decades. You see, a completely intact spaceship dropped so close to Los Alamos makes me very, very suspicious. I seriously doubt that it was caused by an experimental radar station, and if it had been, I believe there would have been an armada, like seen in the Farmington skies 2 years later in 1950, that would have come right away then in 1948 to retrieve it. So that's my take.
Rick, in Steinman's book, they mention the work of an Estonian photographer tasked with photographing the control panels and technology within the craft. Would you please talk more about that?
Sure, Jeff. Incidentally, recall that many countries were occupied by Nazi Germany during World War II. In fact, Project Paperclip was largely about integrating ex-Nazi personnel, scientists, and commanders into the U.S. military and intelligence agencies, as with Reinhard Gehlen into the CIA and Wernher von Braun into the rocket science programs in New Mexico. Numerous paperclip scientists were working in universities throughout the United States by the time of the Aztec crash, and some may have been integrated already into the post-retrieval back engineering teams. It's important to keep in mind that the world's most wealthy families in Europe and the United States drove the politics, corporations, and military during this period of American history. Those families' highest priority was to retain power and control, and this drove the decision-making of the government puppets that they controlled, who appeared to be making the decisions about the non-terrestrial technology that was discovered, and who would benefit financially from these crash retrievals.
That's going to do it for the first part of this interview, looking into the Aztec New Mexico UFO crash recovery and implications down the road with guest Rick Keefe, journalist and longtime researcher into this subject matter. His site is ufohypotheses.com. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.